Begin. We're doing a part two of the questions from the war. So we did a number of questions. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
We did a number of questions last time we met, just 2 weeks ago. A lot of questions. Like I was saying then, I'm going to try to maybe stick to ones that are more relevant to medicine, but not necessarily. They're all fascinating questions. As I mentioned last time, the amazing part is not the answers. The questions are always better than the answers. So the questions are what's amazing here, in the sense of that to have soldiers who are literally fighting for their survival, for their own lives, their family lives, his family's lives, and they're still want to make sure they're doing the right thing, being observant of what the Torah's perspective on many of these issues are. And as we know, the Torah does have perspective. A lot of them, it's interesting, not even, they're just basic questions about Shabbos, how to keep Shabbos. They want to continue to be Torah observant even during the war. The fact that they're fighting a war says they still want to keep Shabbos. To what extent do they have to keep Shabbos? To what extent don't they have to keep Shabbos? To what extent do they put on tefillin? Do they pray? What happens in the middle of a prayer and then they go out middle of the Amidah and they have to leave and they come back? Do they start again? Some of them are basic questions. The fascination to me is the fact that they're even asking these questions. You think it's war. You do everything you can to save your life. You don't start calling your rabbi from the front. But that's what's amazing to me. And again, it's not just religious soldiers. It's even secular soldiers who, as they say, there are no atheists in a foxhole. So when it comes to war, many of these secular soldiers, first of all, it's just in Israel in general now, they say there's people are becoming more religious, more observant. Many secular Israelis who till now were, you could even say, anti-religious. But I think, obviously, due to the war, besides the concept of no atheists in a foxhole, which is applicable here, because all of Israel is in a foxhole at this point with what's going on. You also have, I just think people are, they're inspired by the unity, which obviously was very much lacking in the country prior to October 7th. There was very little unity due to the war and people realizing we're all at this point fighting a common enemy. And I think many, even extreme leftists who till now were pro two states since October 7th have left that opinion in droves because they saw what happens when your neighbors, when you have neighbors who want to kill you. You know, you can make any peace treaty in the world, but it's scary what happened on October 7th. Many people, as you know, the southern kibbutzim, I think we mentioned this, were very left-wing, secular. Many of them are asking the state of Israel is rebuilding many of those kibbutzim. That houses were destroyed and they never had a synagogue in them. Now they want a synagogue. They're calling rabbis and yeshivas to come give classes in their kibbutzim. And so there's a reawakening, which is similar to what happened in 1967 when the Tshuva movement began. Many secular Israelis are even around the world. The whole people in Russia are reawakened, and for whatever reason causes them to come back to the religion at times like this. So it's not just in Israel, as we're saying, but there's a general feeling. I've been to a conference, I watched the conference on Zoom like 2 months ago, where rabbis from Israel were speaking and saying they've been overwhelmed with the phone calls they're getting, not just with halacha questions, but people are asking for classes in all the hotels where you have displaced people, and people were never interested in Torah before. Thousands of, they can't produce enough tzitzis and tefillin for people who now want to put on tzitzis and tefillin. So it's a fascinating thing that's happening in Israel. You have restaurants who were not kosher before, Tel Aviv, koshering their kitchens, and they want to now only do kosher. So there's a phenomenon taking place within Israel and even somewhat in the greater world, on campuses, even in America, where students who before weren't interested in aspects of Judaism are now much more interested, and I've been hearing this from colleagues all over the country, even in this country. So it's a fascinating thing that's going on. But here specifically, we're talking about questions that were posed by soldiers themselves during the war. So I hope I don't repeat anything we said last time, because I don't remember. I jumped around last time in my list of questions here that I wrote down. I wrote down over, right now it's a list of over 30 questions that I've heard from different phone calls with rabbis and discussing these questions with greater rabbis and how to answer them, etc. So I've been writing down questions throughout the last month or so. So I have a list of over 30 questions. So I hope I don't repeat anything, but I'm going to start with one which is just a basic question. And a lot of them are related to principles we've discussed in this class in the past, because obviously we're dealing with life and death here, and that obviously comes up within our class of medical ethics. So one of the first question, which is an old question, which is came up this week also. As you know, they rescued three hostages. Were rescued this week, thank God, a miracle. If you've seen, people don't realize what went into this rescue, the intelligence and how much they had to know. Literally, they were staying in a civilian apartment, of course, in quote-unquote innocent civilians were holding them in an apartment in Gaza, a regular civilian apartment. There were Hamas fighters guarding them, but it was in a regular civilian building, regular apartment, and they had to obviously blow up, get in access to the building without the Hamas fighters realizing initially, in order to rescue the hostages alive, because obviously when you have Hamas fighters guarding them, they're just going to shoot the hostages once they know the Israelis are coming in. So it was all obviously very just miraculous to a certain extent. But one of the things I read is that the actual soldiers, besides obviously any rescue attempt, they're risking their own lives, but they actually protected on the way out. They literally covered the hostages and took, they were leaving under fire when they were rescuing the hostages, and they took fire from, once Hamas realized they were there, they came out and they were shooting at the soldiers. So you're literally risking your life. Soldiers are under fire and they're covering the live hostages, literally laying on them. They were carrying them out. One was in a chair, I think, and they're covering them with their own bodies, risking literally their own lives. So is that permitted to rescue your fellow soldier or a hostage at where you know you're putting your whole life in risk, right? We discussed many times in the past that there's a concept of a chai b'hem, that you don't, even though we have an obligation to rescue, you're not supposed to risk your life to rescue someone else, right? We discussed that in the context of infectious disease, in the context of just jumping in. If you don't know how to swim very well, you're jumping in to save someone from a river, right, where you yourself can drown. So obviously in those cases we said that even though it's pikuach nefesh, you have to save a life, but when it comes, the Torah itself writes that v'chai b'hem, you have to live by the mitzvot. So we have an obligation to rescue, but not at the expense of our own life. So how does that work during wartime? So there's many responses written on this from before October 7th, even from years ago. This was obviously a basic question of war. But Rav Kook already writes, Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Palestine prior to the State of Israel, he was the one of the greatest Zionist leaders at the time, who was an unbelievable scholar and rabbi. And he writes that the principle of v'chai b'hem, this principle that you have to live by the mitzvot and you don't endanger your life, you also have another principle which we've mentioned here many times, which is chayecha kodem l'chayecha vercha. That means your life takes precedence over someone else's life. So again, that's why if I have to rescue someone, or even charity, that principle is applied even with charity. If I give charity at the expense of my own family, it don't mean that you're not going to be able to go on a cruise this year. I mean you're not going to be able to pay your mortgage or feed your family because you're giving too much charity. That's also a problem. The Torah, the principle is your life takes precedence over your friends. That's the famous case we discussed in the past of two people in the desert with a jug of water. I own the water, okay, and there's only enough water for one of us. I don't have to share my water with my fellow man. Okay, that is the halacha, that is the Jewish view. You don't have to risk your life to save someone else. Your life takes precedence, that's what Rabbi Kiva said. in other religions, in Christianity, and you know, they say better, you know, two lives, say, you know, they would obligate you to save your friend, maybe. Judaism, we don't ask people always to be heroes. So that means you don't have to risk your life to save someone else, generally speaking, if you're putting your own life at risk. But when it comes to war, if Cook said, this is obviously, this is very different situation. These principles that we normally talk about within medical ethics of saving lives and your own life takes precedent. That Rabbi Lezer Waldenberg quotes this in one of his responsum. He says it doesn't apply during warfare because warfare, all recruits are obligated. You're basically together as one person. You're one unit, and you're there. That's what war is about. Obviously, if you say that you don't have to sacrifice your life for mitzvah in the Torah, then you couldn't fight a war. Because war inherently is you're signing up to put your life at risk. That's what war is, right? To save the greater community, okay? So all these principles that we're talking about, which is you have to live by the commandments and not die by them, you have to, your life takes precedence over your friend's life, doesn't apply during warfare. That's what Rav Cook says. Rather, he says, all war recruits are obligated to act as one unit and to sacrifice themselves for the sake of his fellow soldier, and also for the public. That's really what the concept of war is. We're sending our boys to the front to save the country. Okay, so obviously there's going to be a risk of losing your life. Another thing he mentions, which is the mitzvah, there is a mitzvah also to conquer the land of Israel. God commanded us to dwell in the land, gave us the land, and there's what we call Mechemet Mitzvah, like we discussed in the past, an obligatory war, which I believe most say this war would be, any defensive war, where you're literally fighting back, they attack and you're fighting back in self-defense, is called an obligatory war, a war of mitzvah. And again, obviously in that case, to conquer the land, it's we're fighting a war, there's going to be a risk to life. One second, Judy. There's going to be a risk, and therefore you part of that fighting the war means to conquer the land of Israel is to endanger your own life. So when you're defending life here, so there's going to be obviously danger to life. So therefore, in that case, everyone would agree that we do risk lives, and in this case, the hostages, in a certain sense, are part of the war effort. This is all part of why we're fighting the war, because they do have currently 134 hostages. Hopefully they're all alive. So there's no question you can risk your life to save the hostage. Judy, go ahead. What was your question?
What about risking your life to get a deceased soldier out of... make sure you recover the body?
That's an excellent question. So there is... excellent question. The Rabbi Waldenberg does have a response about that. I don't want to quote him because I actually tried to look it up before today's class. I couldn't find it immediately, so I don't want to quote him. But I believe he says even that is part of the morale. I believe. I don't want to say definitively because I haven't looked at it in a few years. That response, again, this was written way before this war. He discusses this question and he says the same. It has to do with the morale of the army, meaning since every Israeli soldier knows that every colleague will do everything in his power to make sure to recover his body, which Israel does, as we know, they'll exchange bodies for thousands of Palestinian prisoners just to get back bodies, which they did in the past in Lebanon, and even currently in Gaza, they're holding bodies, as we know. They took bodies, by the way, they just to show how sick these people are. They took bodies knowing this. This is a problem because they know Israel is so, and Judaism is into so much even to recover a body, that they actually kidnapped on October 7th, soldiers that were slaughtered, they kidnapped them, their bodies, and took them back to Gaza knowing that they can use that in negotiations. So it's a blessing and a curse in a certain way. But the fact that soldiers know that their colleagues will do anything to rescue their body, and even at times maybe risk their life, that helps them fight. It's part of lifting the morale of the Israeli army, which I don't know if other armies would even contemplate that. So I believe that's what he says, but I didn't see it in the last few years, so I don't want to quoting from, and I'm getting older, so my memory is not as good, so I don't want to say it definitively. Okay, so that's as far as that question is concerned. So yeah, I believe he says, again, just to answer your question, that even rescuing bodies would be allowed in a case where at least it's not for sure you're going to get killed. Obviously, if you're committing, you know, we don't want someone to get killed for sure, but in a case where it's a doubt, you're rescuing the body under fire, he does allow that, I believe. I have to look it up, and maybe I'll let you know next week. Getting to another tragic question which has come up during this, since October 7th, and again, I'm just going through these questions in a, you know, just on the surface. There's so much, each question could be, you can give a whole class on, literally. But I don't know if we'll do that. Maybe some of the more important ones we'll get back to, and we could give a whole class. But so we're just going to, again, it's more the question than the answer. So the, one of the most tragic questions that have come up since October 7th is the question of abortion. As you know, these Hamas animals literally, you know, raped and pillaged when they came in on October 7th. And they sexually abused men, women, they cut off genitalia. I mean, it's just terrible, the atrocities that were committed by these people, which, of course, the world is not talking about, as we know. Even the women's organizations of the world, which are here to protect women, very few of them are even discussing this publicly, sadly enough, because for whatever reason, Israeli women are not as important as other women in the world. But leaving that aside, leaving all that sad anti-Semitism and politics aside, the questions were posed, actual questions. I know for sure at least two women who became impregnated by Hamas terrorists. And the question becomes, you know, obviously with the question of abortion. There was one woman I know at the Nova Festival where countless women were raped. And the question is, some of them became impregnated. So the question then becomes, can they abort the child according to Jewish law? As we discussed in the past, and this is obviously a very sore topic for many, very emotional topic. So like I said, we're not going to get into all the details, but bottom line is, we know Judaism permits an abortion for the sake of saving the life of the mother. Okay, so that is not a question. Everyone agrees that's not a question. By the way, and it's last week's parasha, where we learn out many of the criteria of how the Torah considers a fetus. Is it a full life? Is it not a full life? Etc. It's from last week's parasha, Parashat Mishpatim, the one we read this past week in Shul. But again, without getting into all the details, everyone agrees that saving the life of the mother is a reason to permit an abortion. Now the question becomes, in a case where it's a psychological, meaning there's no danger for a woman, in this case, let's say a woman, forget this case, a woman who's raped, general case of rape, where a woman becomes impregnated from her rapist, it's not a physical danger technically to the woman, but clearly there's a psychological component, a very great psychological component for a woman to give birth to a child of a rapist. So many, many poskim say, that, first of all, we all agree to a certain extent that psychological danger or mental danger, as we put it in many, and we discussed this in the past, is tantamount in halacha to physical illness. So for example, we allow one to violate Shabbat if someone might have a nervous breakdown. Right, if they don't, whatever the case is, there's no physical danger to the body, but there's a mental danger. They might have a mental breakdown. So of course we allow one to violate Shabbat for that purpose, and someone could take them to the psychiatrist, to the hospital, check them into a mental clinic, whatever the case is, that's allowed. So many poskim want to say the same applies to abortion. Just like we have permitted an abortion we permit violating Shabbat for, like we're saying, for mental illness, because we view, halacha views mental illness as tantamount to physical illness, when it's a serious, we're talking about, you know, not just even an anxiety attack. We discussed that also in the past. That's many cases where someone's having an anxiety attack, we allow certain levels of violation of Shabbat. So the same would apply here, a mental issue of a pregnancy, of a unwanted pregnancy, where it's a serious mental issue, of a woman, a psychological issue, so we would allow an abortion in that case too. Now, it's the reason why it's not so simple, and by the way, this was just practically, let's get it out of the way, this the most of the rabbis, as far as I know, the rabbis that ruled in Israel in the current cases since October 7th all did allow abortions for the women who were impregnated by Hamas terrorists. They did permit abortions. Interestingly enough, in America, Manny, you have a question? You got to show yourself if you're going to... You can't see your beautiful face. And now he muted himself. You muted yourself. I don't know if you meant to do that. But your hand is up.
I'm muted. Oh.
Can you show us?
Can you turn on...
No, we can't see you. But you could ask the question anyway.
I don't know what to do. I can see me.
Okay, you that's very nice.
I can see you.
Did you put your makeup on today?
Stop video.
Okay, go ahead. You can ask. Video. Ask. Ask the question.
I don't know. I'll show me.
You have a question.
Okay. Yes, I do. The wording, I believe, is the wording, I believe, I'll try to get myself shown, but the wording, I believe, is public shame. Public shame.
The wording not, for what? What are you referring to?
But it's called. Well, the woman having a psychological reason for an abortion is to avoid public shame.
Not necessarily. Well. Not, I disagree.
That is why.
Manny, let me explain.
That is why when a woman is. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can I answer you? Can I respond to you?
That is why when a woman is going to be executed and she's pregnant, they first do an abortion to make her avoid public shame.
No, okay. No, I disagree with you. Let me answer.
I don't know what to do about getting lost.
I'm going to respond to you. I disagree with you. It's not necessarily about public shame. It's you know, no one has to know who this child is per se. No one has to know who impregnated her. It's about her own psychological health. She might not be ashamed, but she doesn't want to raise a child of a Hamas terrorist who's a ruthless murderer. This father was a ruthless murderer. He's an animal. And she's going to live with that child and that psychological pain for the rest of her life, knowing she constantly reminded of this tragic act that was perpetrated on her body. I don't know if that's public shame. It's not about the public. It's about her personal life. It doesn't have to be about public. Okay, it's about her psychological pain. That's what we care about. We don't. Public shame is not a reason. We don't allow you to violate Shabbat because of public shame, for example. We don't allow you to violate any.
But we do allow an abortion to avoid public shame.
No, that's wrong. I don't know. Wherever you read that, either it's a bad translation.
Basil Herring.
Okay, Basil Herring. It's not about public shame. I disagree with Basil Herring. He's a nice guy, but I disagree with him. Meaning, it's not about the public shame. It's about the psychological danger to this woman. If she's going to be depressed the rest of her life and have to be on medicine because she gave birth to this child, that's what we care about. It's not about the public. It's about her personal mental health. You understand? That's where I'm disagreeing. We don't... Public shame... Listen, maybe that might be a factor also in her psychological health. But the bottom line is the permission is because she went through this terrible atrocity and she has to live for the rest of her life with it. So it's bad enough she has to live the fact that she was raped and mutilated by some Hamas terrorist or Hamas civilian for that matter that also came into the kibbutzim, by the way. I saw an interview this week with people on a kibbutz in the south in Be'eri where they were saying how she was stuck in her mamat. She heard children, like mothers and children, coming through and going through their belongings and looking for stuff in the fridge. And like, so, you know, a woman and her child came over from Gaza. Once the gates were open, people were just filing in. Forget about the Hamas terrorists. So this is a woman who used to believe in a two-state solution. She said she there's no way she'll ever agree to that again after what she went through. So the point is that, right? So it's their psychological and mental state that's the factor. We don't care about the public. Yes, it could be the public shame is maybe what's causing her psychological factor or part of it. But that's not the permission. We don't care about the public. It's not about the public. It's about her psychological state.
It's not about the public. It's about her shame.
Yeah, No, but it's not only shame. Shame is one word. Yes, shame is associated with rape. There is a concept like that. But it's not only, it's not the shame that can cause psychological factors. There's a lot of parts to it. They feel guilty. There's so many aspects in rape, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not professional, you know, I don't know if I could address that. But there's so many factors when it comes to someone being raped, and also having that baby just aggravates and exacerbates the many of those factors. So it's not necessarily about shame. It could be. Shame could be a part of it, but it's not limited to that, is what I'm saying. And that's not the bottom line. That's not the deciding factor. It's not necessarily about the shame. So that's where I'm disagreeing. We're not arguing in the bottom line is it's permitted. It's just you're limiting it to public shame. I'm saying it's not. That's not the deciding factor.
I'm saying that. Okay.
That could be a factor, yes, for the woman. But what we do is, and this is where it comes down to it, and that's why there's no clear answer. Each abortion, when we're dealing with, it's a life and death situation, it is looked at as separately, and it's assessed. What happened? Where's this woman? Can she withstand? She's assessed by psychiatrists and psychologists to understand what will happen to her if she gives birth to this baby. That's what's the deciding factor. And like I said, so if you say, so it really depends, and it boils down to this, which is an important factor. Again, we're not going to get into all the details of the laws of abortion from the Torah perspective, but if you say abortion is not murder, that we believe the fetus is not murder, which is the normative view within Judaism, that a fetus is not a full life, so then it's much more easy to be lenient, it's easier. In most cases, we're going to permit it because the whole thing is rabbinical. The prohibition might even be just rabbinical. If Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion, extreme opinion, and not many agree with him, that no, a fetus is a full life and it's murder. It's not capital murder, but it is a full life. And therefore, according to his view, it would be much harder to permit an abortion because it's a murder. So it would have to be an extreme psychological case where the woman will have a nervous breakdown and she could harm herself. That would be a place where it would be permitted. But the bar is much higher if you say that the fetus is a full life, obviously, to permit the abortion. And most of the rabbis in Israel are of the opinion, not only current rabbis, past rabbis, are of the opinion that the fetus is not a full life. And therefore, they're very lenient in these cases. So, by the way, hostages, I don't know of it for sure, but I believe that also some of the hostages were raped and became impregnated. I only heard cases of the Nova Festival where women became impregnated from their Hamas fighters. I don't know of cases yet, or we might not know all the cases yet of the hostages. So each case has to be considered differently. There was a story, I said this in the past, of the Satmar Rebbe, who a woman in the community was raped and by someone of a different culture. It was an African American. She wasn't sure if the baby was going to be African American. And the Rebbe said, I want to meet with her. And he sat down for over 2.5 hours with this woman. And he came out of the meeting and he said, this woman is psychologically strong. She, after speaking with her for 2.5 hours, she would be able to handle having this baby. And he didn't allow an abortion in that case. Sounds crazy, but I don't know what the end of the story is, but he, in that case, with the woman, meaning the woman was interested in Harry, she accepted his answer. It wasn't like she was fighting and she said, am I allowed to or not? It was a halachic question, and he, after meeting with her for 2.5 hours, they both came to the conclusion that she can survive mentally, and listen, it's not going to be easy, no one's saying it's easy, but in this case, so whatever the case, they gave up the baby for adoption. But she went ahead and he ruled in that case, and she gave birth to that child. So I know it's a very emotional topic, but we're not going to get in. There's a lot of, especially in the state of Texas, which we know is extreme in their views of abortion, which I've been dealing with a lot of ramifications. I had recently, in the last 2 months, I had two people in the Orthodox community who required an abortion, not for rape, for, you know, defective, you know, fetus had major defects, and I've been dealing with it was just ridiculous dealing with the state of Texas. They both halachically were permitted to have abortions, but the state of Texas, they couldn't do it here in the state. And by the time they found out many, one of them at least for sure, it was too late to do the abortion. Even New York State wouldn't do it at that point, even though halachically you can. So just, it's something to understand that even though halacha doesn't allow abortion at will, but what many of these states are doing, as we discussed in the past, that are passing these extreme laws where the hospitals won't even talk to the woman about an abortion, about going to a different state. That's how scared the doctors are of the legal ramifications if they advise a patient to go to a different state to have an abortion. They can't even send the records in many cases. So these two poor women that I dealt with recently had to go through this terrible thing because of the extreme laws of our state. Again, I'm not, Judaism, as always, as we always discuss, is right down the middle. It's not like the Christian right, which is abortion is a murder in most cases, but it's not like the extreme left where abortion is allowed at will. So you have a problem when these states pass laws. They're clearly, unfortunately, in our society, we're so polarized that they go to the opposite extreme where you can't even, you know, I told you, I've had cases in the past where a woman's life was in danger and they wouldn't allow the abortion. They wouldn't even allow a DNC. She was pregnant with twins. I had a case like 2 years ago almost already, right after the law was passed, where the Texas Children wouldn't give this woman one twin died, and they had to do a DNC, but they said it might, mistakenly, in the DNC, there's a risk of aborting the other child. They do, you know, they do a DNC, they wouldn't do that. And the woman, they said, she has to go home, get infected. When she's infected, she can come back and have her DNC. Then we could do it. Only once she has an infection. Which is, it's ludicrous. So I'm realizing more and more how crazy and extreme many of these states are in their passing of these laws, which is surely connected, it's against what the Torah's perspective is. Manny, what's your question?
Did you say that an abortion is halachically allowed for a fetal abnormality? I think you just said that.
I said I had two cases where it was allowed, depending on the fetal abnormality, depending on the case, depending on what trimester. So we're not getting into all the details, but there are cases, yes, that it is. Yes, there are many cases where it would be allowed. Again, if you say a fetus is not a full life. So yes, there are. I just had two cases where, in consultation let me explain. I had two cases recently. I said where in the last 2 months, people in the Orthodox community who we did allow an abortion for, one couldn't
what
didn't
were
end
the
up.
Problems?
We're not getting into it. No, we're not getting into it now because just it's not relevant.
How far they were, I'd like to know.
So one was
it's not the usual.
It depends who your rabbi is. Maybe you have an extreme rabbi who won't rule leniently. You gotta choose your rabbis right, Manny. Maybe you chose the wrong rabbi. Okay, so next question. So moving on again, it's tragic to some, like this question of abortion is obviously a tragic question. As far as I know, so far all the cases in Israel they did permit. All the cases where women were impregnated, I don't know how many cases there were, but I know of at least two where they did permit abortion for the woman to abort the child of the Hamas rapist. So the interesting question that I saw, another question, which is, it was a soldier, the reason why I'm stating this question, it's a Shabbat question, but it's relevant to doctors also. That's why I'm gonna read it. A soldier was freed. He had 20 hours free from Gaza, and it was Friday afternoon. He was in a tank unit. This is a question that was posed, an actual question was posed to the rabbi, but they told him he can go home. He was Shabbat observant. He was Shomer Shabbat. He can go home Friday afternoon, but he has to be back on Shabbat afternoon. Back to his unit to go back into Gaza. So it means he would have to violate Shabbat. He's going home knowing he's going to have to violate Shabbat to get back to his unit. They were giving him whatever 15-hour break, 20-hour, whatever it was. So they're letting off on a Friday afternoon knowing he's going to have to drive back to Gaza or to the, you know, the launching base near Gaza on Shabbos. So is he allowed to go home for Shabbos knowing he's going to have to go violate Shabbat to get back to his base tomorrow afternoon? That's when they need him. So right now, there's no meaning. Technically, he could stay where he is. He could stay in the base and not go home for Shabbat, not go home on Friday. So is he obligated to do that? So they ruled in that case. So the reason why I'm saying this question is because this is very relevant to physicians on call. So in other words, you're in a hospital, you're going home Friday before Shabbat, so for a Shomer Shabbos physician, and now they know they're gonna have to come back in tomorrow. So maybe they have to stay in a hotel near the hospital or in the hospital itself and not go home. So in that case, almost all, everyone rules, in the case of war, and also relevant, like we're saying, applicable to a physician, is you're allowed to go home for Shabbat. Because first of all, especially in a war, and the same, as we know, doctors are, you know, I don't want to put them on the level of soldiers, but they are fighting the war of disease. So in that sense, meaning you need to rest. A person needs to go home, be with his family, he needs to rest. It's not about Shabbat or not Shabbat. Right now, there's no situation of danger to a life when you're going home, that's true. But if you don't rest, and we don't allow you to go home, you know, you're going to come back exhausted or you're sleeping in the hospital, you're not going to be as good a fighter. You might not do your practice your medicine as good, and therefore we allow you to go home knowing that you're going to have to violate Shabbat tomorrow. And this applies to doctors, it applies to soldiers. It's the same concept applies in both cases. In this case, Rav Asher Weiss, who was during the war, he made this analogy to doctors, and he said it's permitted to go home on Friday, even knowing you're going to have to come back tomorrow on Shabbat. Yeah, Eddie, go ahead.
And in addition, it's an important factor in keeping morale high.
Doctors or soldiers?
All of the above. I mean, you talked earlier about the need to keep the morale up when you were talking about recovering bodies. Certainly getting to see your family and getting a little rest is important to the morale of the troops as well.
Yes, so that for sure is part of it. I would only apply probably that concept to the soldiers, not the doctors. Doctors always have high morale. But again, the point is, it's a little more complicated. I'm not getting into the details, but it's about...
I mean, doctors need high morale as well, because those are military doctors, so they need morale.
Oh, I'm not talking about military doctors. Yeah, military doctors for sure.
Is practicing medicine, but so it applies to soldiers and doctors equally, that they have to have high morale in order to do the extended hours. And
yes,
the,
true. But I'm taking when I was saying doctors,
sacrifice,
I meant Eddie. You're correct. I agree with you. That's a military doctor. When I was saying physicians, I meant all physicians, not just military physicians. Okay, so. Meaning a regular physician who's on call in the hospital, meaning he's going home Friday afternoon, he's finished his hours, but he knows he's going to have to come back in the morning. So is he allowed to go home? Maybe he has to stay in the hospital. So that's a general question that comes up. It's relevant to cases of, let's say, even a woman. Let's say a woman starts her labor, you know, before Shabbat. She knows she's going to have to drive, or she knows she's due, so she knows she's going to have to drive on Shabbat to the hospital. Of course, you're allowed to, but does she have to go in before Shabbat and stay, you know, let's say she knows she started her labor, but she has another 14 hours to go. Does she have to drive to the hospital out of Shabbat because she knows she's going to have to violate Shabbat tomorrow? So it's not only a question of, right now, there's no situation of pikuach nefesh. There's no danger at this point. So don't go home, maybe stay in the hospital. So they all rule in those cases that you don't have to do that. A woman doesn't have to go in or stay in a hotel near the hospital before Shabbat, knowing she might go into labor tomorrow. So it's the same. That's the same concept. So it's not about the permission is not necessarily related to morale. It's purely a technical issue. Morale obviously is a factor when it comes to a soldier also, that he can fight better by going home and he's been with his family. Obviously he'll be a better fighter. So yes, there was a case I heard, by the way. Just to show you the beauty of what's going on. As we know, there are many people donating stuff and sending money, and so there was one of the rabbis I heard speaking. He said he was in a car he was in a car and a soldier driving with a foreigner, with an American guy who was visiting, a tourist who was taking around. He's an army rabbi, I'm not sure. He's taking around to the bases, and they got a phone call from a platoon that they released them. This question, that they let them go home. So I'm not sure what the case was. They would have to drive back on Shabbat, I think. I'm just trying to remember the story. And they let them in a hotel near Gaza, but their families wouldn't be able to join. There's not enough time before Shabbat. So let's say it was Friday at 12 o'clock, or they don't know if they can't make it home. So they're staying in a hotel near the border. The army put them in a hotel, or some of the soldiers. So the question was, could the families come to them on Shabbat? So that's already a whole different story. It's not, the fighters are not violating, it's not for the fighters, but their families had a question, could they drive to the hotel? They might end up violating Shabbat. So I'm mixing up the story. Whatever it is, this donor who was in the car with the rabbi said he'll sponsor all the families to come to the hotel for Shabbat. So I think it was 120 soldiers. He paid on the spot. He was a rabbi from a congregation in Teaneck, New Jersey, I think. And he called up the congregation. They donated free for all the families to come stay with their husbands for Shabbat in the hotel, so they won't have to violate Shabbat, something like that. So just the beauty of what's going on. This is also another tragic case from that. Many of the cars, I don't know if you've seen those videos of the attacks on October 7th, so they burnt cars with bodies in them. I mean, some of them with live people. They lit everything on fire, and whole cars, they were just shooting up cars. It was at the festival. They attacked them as they were, everyone realized there's something going on. So they all were leaving. There was one, bottleneck where they all had to leave the festival on October 7th, and they just had hundreds of Hamas fighters lined up on the roads and just shooting at the cars. So you had cars with six people in them, everyone's jumping into cars, and literally the cars were soaked with blood, the seats. So as we know, in Judaism, we have to bury, you're supposed to bury the person with all the blood, whatever, if someone dies on the operating table, everything needs to be buried. So the question became, what do they do with these cars that were soaked with blood? Can they just put them in the junkyard? So one rabbi ruled, it's fascinating, I saw pictures of this, that they have to remove the seats from the cars, and they buried the seats. That's how soaked, there was so much blood on these seats that they actually buried the, sometimes whole cars were buried. That's what this rabbi ruled, which is interesting. So if they can't get the blood out of the seat, he said they should bury the seat. So just tragic. This was another similar type case, just going to mention. So it might sound weird to you, but as we know, the laws of Nida is when a woman's menstruating, so she can't be with her husband. She has to go to the mikvah right before, at the end of her menstrual cycle. It's a matter of 12 days. Now, we're not going to get into all the various details of the law, but there's 5 days that the woman, after she starts bleeding, she has to wait. 7 days, she has to have 7 clean days after her cycle, then she goes to the mikvah. So the question many of the soldiers, religious soldiers, were asking about, let's say their wife, they're home, they're off from the war, and they're leaving, their wife is an Ida, so they understand, they can't have relations, but the guys, there's also, not only is it about relations, the halacha says, you don't even touch your wife, because we're scared, as, might lead to something, right? If you dance with her, it might lead to something. So therefore, the halacha is you're not even supposed to touch your wife. So the question was, this guy saying, I might never see my wife again. This is the last time he's leaving back to the base. His wife is during her cycle. He wanted to know, can he hug his wife? Okay, so there's some rabbis who wanted to permit it. It was a big, most rabbis were not happy about it because it's a serious violation. In the Torah, it's a biblical violation. But one rabbi said he got the question in a different way. So he said like this, he said that a soldier called him and he said he knows he's going home from the base for Shabbat, he's going home for whatever it was, I don't know, for Shabbat, not Shabbat, and he knows his wife is in her seven clean days. He knows he's not going to be able to control himself. When he's leaving, he's going to have to hug her. He knows that before he's going home. He says, there's no way I'm going to be able to control myself. Am I allowed to go home? That was his question. Just to show you where these people are, how crazy these soldiers, that was his question to the rabbi. He knows that if he goes home, he's going to end up, hugging her for sure, at least. So is he allowed to go home? Maybe he shouldn't go home. So the rabbi ruled, no, you have to go home. And he said, I'll pray for you that hopefully you won't violate the sin, but you need to go home. That's he compared it to, the Talmud discusses a case. He said it's analogous. The Talmud talks about, let's say you have, two ways to go, to walk somewhere. Okay, the Talmud says, and one just to take an extreme case, it's a nude beach. And there's a house of ill repute on that street. And if you walk down that street, you might end up in that house. When you have another way to go. So the Talmud says, am I allowed to walk down that street? So the Talmud says, if there's two ways, you have a fork in the road, you can go this way or that way. And you choose to walk down the street with the house of ill repute and put yourself in a, in a situation where you might end up sinning. Says the Talmud, then that's prohibited. But if there's no other way to go, the only way to get home is through that street that has this house of ill repute. So then you're allowed to go, and you have to, be strong and make sure. One second, let me finish the analogy, and I'll let you ask your question. So he says this is the case where you have no choice. You have to go home. Your family hasn't seen you, whatever it is, a certain amount of weeks. You need to go home. There's no two choices here. It's not you have staying in the base when you're free and not going home to your family is not an option. It's considered where you only have one choice. You have to go home. He says, God will help you that you'll be strong and you won't violate the prohibition. That was what this rabbi ruled. Eddie, go ahead.
Well, this raises a question. I know it's been a long time since I've raised this question, but there's a certain part of halakha that comes from rabbinic law that's not really a part of Torah or Talmudic law, where the rabbis say, well, we need to really go to an extreme well beyond what the law says in order to make sure we don't accidentally violate the law.
Yes.
Another example is, why do we have to wait 6 hours between dairy and meat? It's because, we might get below 2 hours, so we'll make it 6 hours. And so, the question in my mind, and I'll raise it since Ron isn't here to raise it today, but the question in my mind is, when rabbis make a part of halakha something that's really not a violation of the law, but an extra amount just to make sure you don't even come close to violating a real law, if you will, is that really a law that has to be followed, or can we
excellent question.
And find this is an extreme abundance of caution beyond what the law
is. So excellent question, and you said it much more softer than Ron would, so I appreciate that. Ron would have been much more aggressive in the question. So, but the excellent question. So you're right. If it's purely rabbinical law and it's just a fence, so yes, the rab, of course, we're going to be much more lenient when it comes to a case like this. And but there's no question. But this, by the way, many are of the opinion that hugging one's wife or touching one's wife is a biblical violation. So you're correct. When there's a rabbinical law, like we're saying in abortion, there are those that say abortion is only rabbinically prohibited. There are those opinions. So according to them, of course, we're going to be lenient when it comes to a case where a woman was raped. The bar is so much lower because it's rabbinical. So you're 100% correct. When we're dealing with a biblical violation, we're much stricter in trying to find a leniency. When we're dealing with rabbinical law, or for sure, if it's just offense, many times that we say the rabbis would not say it in this case. They wouldn't apply it you know, even originally, to a case where someone's ill or someone, you know, so you're 100% correct. We find that throughout halakha that we're much more lenient in violating Shabbat in a rabbinical way, or when it comes to different situations, whether it's there might be a potential danger. There's so many cases, so I agree with you 100%. In this particular case, almost all agree, at least Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch all say that it's a biblical violation in that case. So that's why it was an issue. But you're 100% correct. Okay, so let's try to get in a few more. See what else I got here. This by the way, the whole question I saw, which you know, addresses the friendly. As you know, there was a lot of friendly fire incidents. In all wars, there are. As we know, there were three hostages that were killed a number of weeks ago by Israeli soldiers. They came out with white flags, and the Israeli soldier shot them. Whatever the circumstances of that were, they're doing an investigation. It's not clear, but clearly, I mean, because there sounds like there were many cases where Hamas terrorists came out with white flags as a ruse. And then ambushed Israeli soldiers. So it was fair. But whatever the case was, I think they're saying, if I remember the number, over 10% of deaths of Israeli soldiers in Gaza are friendly fire, which I don't think is so abnormal. That I think that might even be low compared to normal war. Part of war is, you know, when you're in a situation where you're firing live fire, there's going to be deaths from friendly fire. So. The question came up, soldiers were asking, were involved in many of these cases, do they have to, what's the story? Do they have to repent? What do they have to do to, you know, they felt terrible, besides obviously living with that guilt of killing a fellow soldier, of course, technically not a fault of their own, it wasn't intentional, but how does that work? And this is something, the reason why I'm bringing it up, so they were discussing this with the rabbis were discussing the situation, they were asked, questions by soldiers, actually. What do they have to do to sort of atone for what they did? Or do they need atonement? Is it something that doesn't need any atonement at all? How does that work? So the reason why I bring it up is because this is something we've discussed in the past in relation to physicians who are many times mistakenly, not negligently, but sometimes do the wrong thing and mess up, and they can end up killing a patient. And it's similar, there's no question, it's the same case. Because what's happening here is you're involved in a mitzvah, technically. You're involved, just like as a physician is involved in a mitzvah of healing. And in the context of that mitzvah, there's a danger. Sometimes you might prescribe, the guy has an allergic reaction to the medicine you prescribed. Or whatever happened, the situation, many times in a surgery, you could end up killing a patient. And again, we're not talking about where there's negligence. Obviously, that's something else. We're talking about where there's no negligence. But sometimes, for whatever reason, the patient ends up dying on the operating table or many such instances. So how does that work? And I believe many years ago we've discussed this in a whole class. Maybe we will give a class about it. But it's really the same question here. And this was posed to the rabbis with friendly fire, because these soldiers are involved in a mitzvah, obviously. And their mitzvah of they're fighting a defensive war, which, as we said, is a mitzvah. Now they end up killing a fellow soldier unintentionally. How does that work? Or a hostage? So we've discussed this during COVID, I believe. There were two cases I'm remembering offhand during COVID, where one was a nurse who was putting someone on a ventilator, and she put the wrong tube in or something. I don't exactly remember the details of the case. She unintentionally, by the way, and this nurse was, she was on, this was like her third shift. As we know, during COVID, there was a shortage of medical personnel in many of the hospitals, and due to the, you know, the crazy amount of patients also in some of the hospitals in New York, etc., and there wasn't enough machines, and there was very intense pressure, and this nurse, her boss, it seems, asked her to stay an extra shift, and she ended up connecting the wrong tube. She accidentally killed the patient. So she also, the question was, she asked the rabbi, what did she do something wrong? Meaning, does she have to repent? Does she have to atone? If I remember correctly, there was a nurse in Tennessee or something who was, they put her on trial for one of the, a case like this during COVID, I believe, where she connected the wrong tube. So this is, again, it's the same question with friendly fire. And again, we're not going to get into all the details, but basically, we had the question during COVID of a guy, a medical care worker in a nursing home who was on lockdown, and they told everyone not to go home, they can't leave. And this guy went home, his kids or something had COVID, and he ended up coming back. He didn't know his kids had COVID. He ended up coming back to the nursing home, and he infected many patients. This was in Israel. This happened, and we discussed that question then also. So it's all this question, as we know, the Torah discusses intense, in many cases, a case of what's called the unintentional killing. It's actually also in last week's parasha. And there's when someone unintentionally is chopping down a tree and the head of his axe flies off or whatever, can kill someone, right? So that's a famous case. The Torah describes that the person has to go to Galut. Galut means he has to go. There were cities of refuge where you'd have to go to. And believe it or not, the Shulchan Aruch discusses this in the context of a physician also. It says that if a physician kills someone unintentionally, he also has to go to a city of refuge. So today, by the way, practically, the cities of refuge are all in the West Bank in Arab towns today. I mean, there is the biblical cities of refuge. One of them is Nablus, which I don't advise you to go visit there. Probably not a good thing for your life. But the point is, so how does it work today? So there's a lot of discussion, again, in this context where does the person need repentance or not? Again, we're not going to get into all the details, but there are rabbis who say you should do something, give charity. In actuality, of course, we don't go to cities of refuge today. But Rabbi Weiss, Rabbi Asher Weiss, is one of the great rabbis, an American rabbi who lives in Israel and is very involved in the war effort in ruling on these questions. I didn't see the letter, but I heard about it, maybe I'll try to get a copy. He wrote a letter, I believe it's to the soldiers who were involved in killing the hostages. And he wrote a long letter to them saying, do not think twice about this. And again, maybe it has to do with what Eddie said before, the morale. But he knows, as it is, obviously these people, can you imagine that you have to live with the rest of your life after you killed three hostages, unintentionally. So he wrote a long letter to them and others involved in friendly fire to this platoon, saying, you were doing your job, you were involved in the mitzvah, you don't even think twice about what you're doing. Right now you're in the war and you have to continue your war effort. You have to be proud of what you accomplished. And unfortunately, friendly fire, as we're saying, happens in war. And there are screw-ups and hostages were killed. But you have no reason, he says, to do tshuva at this point. I didn't see the letter, so I can't quote it verbatim. But I believe his rationale is because in a case like this, you can't tell the soldiers they did something wrong. I mean, they feel terrible, they're depressed, and to bring down, it would totally bring the morale down in a case like that where you're telling the soldiers that they have to now atone for the sin they did by killing these innocent people. So I believe that, again, I didn't see the letter, so I can't quote it exactly, his rationale.